Welcome back to Earth Station Trek, a show where we trek from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between. Today, we're going to jump right back into our discussion of our favorite legacy Star Trek episodes, picking up with Star Trek Voyager. Now, Voyager, I'll admit, is not my favorite series. I felt like it suffered in comparison to Deep Space Nine, but Voyager's great for individual sci-fi stories, even if it wasn't an arc-based long story like Deep Space Nine.
Right. Totally agree with you on
that. Same here.
And so the one that I went with was Tuvix.
Wow.
And Tuvix is one of those iconic episodes that people talk about a lot. I thought 30 years later, I don't think anyone's sure if Captain Janeway made the right choice. Because, you know, in that episode, I don't know if you remember it, but...
We were just watching it the other day.
Oh, were we? Maybe or I was asleep.
I may have been partly asleep, but I remember it.
Neelix and Tuvok are combined into a new entity via the transporter who doesn't want to go back. He remembers being Neelix and remembers being Tuvok, and he wants to stay Tuvix, and she has to make the choice for him. Janeway, I think people are still arguing whether Janeway killed Tuvix. And, you know, it's one of those great Star Trek ethical dilemmas. Like, is she saving Neelix and Tuvok, or is she killing Tuvix? And I personally liked Tuvix better than Neelix and Tuvok combined, so I was happy to keep Tuvix. So I don't know, it's just a great Star Trek conceit, as long as you don't think about too much about how their outfits got combined as well into the Tuvix's
exactly
garb. But
exactly,
no, I think that, and I forget the name of the guest actor, but he did a great job as Tuvix, and it's just one of those that people, as long as there are Star Trek fans, they'll be arguing about Tuvix.
So what does everybody think? Does she do the right thing or not?
Yes.
What do you think?
I think not.
I think not.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'd have kept Tuvix, but that's just me.
I think it's a tough one because I think, and here's the thing. To your point, since Neelix and Tuvok were still alive in him, you kind of sort of can't say they died. Their personalities are still there. I that's a tough one because he was a new sentient being and he begged them. And it's one of the most gut-wrenching episodes in all of Star Trek. Because you never see is anyone begging a Starfleet person not to kill me. And he begged them. He was looking around at them going, "You're good people. You can't do this." That's a rough one to watch. I just watched that last month. I don't know where I stand on that to this day. That is a really tough one. And I love that really powerful little scene, back to little scenes, where the doctor says, "I won't do this."
Right.
And she makes the doctor stand aside. The doctor says, "I am not going to do this. I don't agree with what you're doing." And so Janeway has to do the action because the doctor, as a doctor, is first do no harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of the things from the time I was very small that just drew me to Star Trek was the fact that it's not just, you know, heroes in colorful outfits adventuring, you know, shooting the bad guys. Is you have these great moral dilemmas that, you know, even as a young person, just being forced to think a little more during your adventure program than another show would. And I think the Doctor Who actor Christopher Eccleston said it best: you give them something good when they're young and they'll crave it when they're older.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And Eccleston, he's a wise man.
Absolutely.
All right, Keith, your pick for Star Trek Voyager.
Well, not to do what you did and follow behind you, say the same thing, but it is true. Voyager is probably my least favorite of the original group of Star Treks. I never disliked it, but it never just drew me in. You know, it wasn't one of those where I thought, oh, man. And I think what you said about it being great episodic television, it has really good individual science fiction shows here and there. But overall, it's not that show that gives me the passion like The Wars with Deep Space Nine,
right,
or some things Worf on TNG or the original series. And I'm in the middle of a Voyager rewatch now, and I'm liking it more than I thought I would again. But try it's not just scintillating. And personally, I feel that when 7 and 9 came on board, she sucked all the air out of the show, personal opinion, because too many shows focused on her. Mm. But a show that I absolutely love from the science fiction point of view is Distant Origin.
Mm. Yes.
And
Distant
Origin is the episode where they encounter an incredibly advanced Saurian race that it turns out are the descendants of the dinosaurs who left Earth millions of years ago and are traveling around the Delta Quadrant on this ridiculously large city spaceship. So big, they literally beamed Voyager inside the ship, and it looks like Voyager was lost. And as advanced as they are, they have this incredible theocracy that basically thinks of all mammalians as inferior species, and any talk that they came from Earth, any talk that they weren't born in the Delta Quadrant, that they're not basically the rightful masters of the Delta Quadrant, and any talk that they share DNA with lesser species like us is forbidden. You can be punished and possibly killed for it. And in the episode, Chakotay ends up getting kidnapped by an archaeologist who's trying to prove this theory, which is called distant origin, that their species didn't arrive in the Delta Quadrant, but somewhere else. And throughout the show, he and the scientists realize, no, these people did come from Earth. But as they try to prove this, the lady who rules that city ship is so hell-bent on crushing that thought, crushing that heresy, that she was going to destroy the Voyager and imprison all the people. And at the end of the show, they have to back away from telling these people the truth. What I like about it, one, is the science fiction aspect is just phenomenal. I love that concept. I don't know how logical it'd be that you'd have a Saurian race on Earth and we don't see any presence.
Yeah, it's not very logical.
Yeah, because if they use anything approaching...
Ignoring that.
Yeah, ignoring, right. Because if they use anything approaching metal and technology or something, we would have found something in the fossil layers. But Justin, a fascinating thing, but kind of going back to what I feel about who watches the Watchers, and I think a lot of it's because I was raised very religious. My late father was a preacher, and I was, you know, steeped in standard Christian thought like so many people. It's fascinating how wanting to believe something can make you refuse everything that's in front of you. And there was a great scene. Another reason I like it is because it shows Chakotay, who in my opinion didn't get enough to do on the series. Chakotay gives a really good speech, which doesn't sound like a typical Star Trek speech, but he tells the matriarch, he says, when she says, how dare you say that we came from another part of the galaxy, that we were some kind of vagabonds, you know, tramps who made our way here. And it's basically, how dare you say we came from such low origins? And Chakotay says, that's not what I see. I see a race of people who came to intelligence and starship travel long before we did. I see a people who traveled across the galaxy and made it in a completely new territory. I see them come to these incredible heights of technology, and she doesn't want to hear it. And I thought the speech, what he said, was moving. She's like, no, you're going against some doctrine. And that was the thing. You're going against doctrine. And at the end of the thing, it's all crushed. The archaeologist has to change careers, and Voyager was told, don't you ever cross our path again. That was kind of the end of that. It's just a fascinating science fiction story. It's fascinating from a philosophical thing. And they're one of those races you come across every now and then where you would think, what in the heck would those people do if they came across the Borg? Or have they come across the Borg?
Right. Yeah, it's one of those great one-offs that you wish you'd see again.
Yes.
You know, you could have done a lot with that storyline. But, you know, also it's a great parallel to, you know, just scientific history of people like Galileo or Darwin, whose scientific findings challenge the religious orthodoxy of the day. Absolutely. But, you know, set in Star Trek.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just and also to your point, the whole thing about where you come from dictates who you are, because the thing was, how dare you say we're related to you lowly mammalians? That was one of the things they couldn't stomach.
Well, it's the equivalent of I didn't come from no monkey.
Exactly. Right.
I want to say on a totally production standpoint, the makeup and prosthetics were incredibly well done.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Beautifully done.
Definitely. Yeah. I looked at it very closely because sometimes you're right. You can kind of see you can see the stuff attached to the nose. They did fantastic work on that episode.
All right, Alan, your choice for Star Trek Deep Space. Star Trek Voyager.
Wait, I get to pick another one for DS9?
Well, Veronica picked three.
Damn. Okay. This is funny because when I was going through my list, Distant Origin was one of the ones that I was considering.
Wow.
And the one that I've picked is actually two episodes before it. Okay. Like I said earlier, I'm drawn to characters that have mental abilities and certainly ones that have a natural limitation. In Kes's case, the limitation is more that she's not around Ocampans and she doesn't have, like, she's has this sort of awakening ability, but she doesn't understand it. It doesn't really know how to use it. So I went with Before and After, which, Charles, as you were saying, Voyager did really good standalone sci-fi concept episodes, and this is one of my favorites. It starts a couple of years in the future at the moment of Kes's death and goes backwards all the way to when she's basically an egg in her mother's womb. And along the way, it stops at all these different points where she has to try and convince the people around her, which every jump is an earlier point, who she is, what's going on with her, and figure out a way that they can fix it. And one of those stops, this is from season three, one of those stops is this whole setup, which when you get around to season four, you realize is the two-part episode Year of Hell. Mm. So they're basically precursoring a season four two-parter with scenes in this one episode. And it's just a brilliant concept where you're seeing her life story in reverse. Okampans only live 9 years. And I think that one of the things, you know, I think they always struggled with the concept of Kes's character. And I think that one of the big things that they really missed was to show that accelerated aging and the effect that it would have on her and the effect that it would have on the people around her who care about her. And they're watching her age at a rate that's much quicker than what they're experiencing. So this episode is one of the few that actually addresses it, where it's only like, what, 3 years down the road, but she's on her deathbed. Mm. And seeing her life basically in rewind, where you also get points before she joins Voyager, and she's a young girl with her family and all this kind of stuff, giving you more backstory on her than we'd ever really gotten before that point, is, I think, really, really inventive storytelling, and one that I absolutely adore, partly because of the way that you don't realize it when you're watching it for the first time, but they are very specifically setting up a storyline they are going to tell you a season down the road. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. Now, the bad thing about that is that Kes leaves at the end of this season. And when they actually come around to Year of Hell in the middle of season three, they don't reference that, you know, that episode at all. I mean, even if Kes isn't around, they could have said, oh my gosh, this is that thing that Kes was telling us about last year before she left. Just a little line like that would have made that that whole bow just get tied in the most beautiful way.
Right.
So I thought about picking Year of Hell as my top selection, but Before and After is just one that I'm really, really fond of in every possible way.
Yeah, Voyager had some great time episodes where they're just playing with,
yes.
The one where the ship gets fractured in time and different levels of the ship.
I almost picked that one too.
On the show or relativity.
Yes, it was in season seven, and it was basically Voyager's greatest hits before going off the air. And I almost picked that one. I almost also picked episode number 100, Timeless. Oh man.
I just watched Timeless and I thought about that one as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Star Trek does so many great time travel shows. I actually made a conscious effort not to choose a time travel show, although which is weird, but you're right. And one of the things about, you know, it, as everybody knows, unfortunately, Jennifer Lean still has so many problems. I know she's had some serious mental health issues. And I think as recently as last month or so, she was in trouble with the law again. Mm. Somebody said she was outside yelling at children and something. And it's so sad because she is absolutely one of the best actors I think Star Trek ever had.
Yeah.
They talk about how some of the other cast members talk about how Jennifer Lean was in her extremely early 20s. I think she was absolutely the youngest person on the show, even younger than Garrett Wong. And she has such a presence about her. She reminds you of the women who are often hired in the original series, like Diana Muldaur. You know, the women who had class and kind of a sophistication. They had a presence about them. Jennifer Lean is so young, but she was such an incredibly good actress. And I never did find out, did she leave the show on her own because she was having problems, or did they write her off the show and replace her with Seven? But I agree, it was a loss.
Yeah, I just recently heard that people are finally talking about the real story of Jessica Lean in the new Voyager book that's coming out. Because it's been such a long time, but it was very hush-hush and everyone sort of repeating the company line for several years. But I think that a lot of the issues that she's having now started back then.
Yeah.
I don't want to start crapping on Jennifer Lean because I agree with you. I think she was great on Voyager and I would have loved to have seen more of Kes. And to Alan's point, I think it would have been great for Voyager to allow her to grow into old age and be, you know, an elderly woman having lived her life on the show would have been a very fascinating thing and very Voyager-esque. And I'm sorry that that didn't
absolutely
work out.
Absolutely. It would have been a storytelling angle that Trek had never had the opportunity to do right before. It's like going back to DS9, a lot of people don't like the fact that Terry Farrell left after six seasons and they added a new Dax. But I argue that it's an incredible shame to have a Trill main character and not investigate the impact that changing hosts has
right
on that character and on the people around her too. Yeah. So it's the same way here. It's a shame to have a character who has a 9-year lifespan. When your show is 7 years, that covers the majority of her life, and not explore that.
Right.
That's an interesting point. I've never actually heard anybody say that. That's a very interesting point. I've never even thought about that.
And at least, like you say, with Ezri, it sort of brought that character full circle from having been mm-hmm. Sisko's mentor to his peer to now he's the mentor
mm-hmm.
with Dax, which and I like Seven of Nine, and I liked her on the show. She's one of my favorite Voyager characters, but I would have loved for Kes to continue as well, because I thought Kes was great.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things, talking about Seven of Nine, which one of the things is I kind of felt like, and I think that I've seen Kate Mulgrew say this as well, that they sort of lost the point of the Janeway character. And, yeah, you know, I have mixed feelings about them bringing on Seven of Nine. I ended up loving her. But the thing that I really was a big fan of is that bringing Seven of Nine into the show put a whole new focus on Janeway. And all of a sudden, Janeway had a purpose. Mm. You know, she had this drive, and I think that bringing in Seven of Nine sort of reinvigorated the writer's ability to focus on Janeway.
Right, and in a way, it gave her a Spock, but also in another way, it gave right her a reason to be a mother figure, more so than she was to the rest of the
exactly
crew.
Exactly. Exactly
and,
right.
And like with Troy, though, I liked it better when, in relativity, when Seven got to wear a uniform. A product of the Berman era.
Yeah, because what you guys said is I was watching Jerry Ryan do, there's the episode where there's a malfunctioning in this board device called a verticillium. Basically, it's causing all of her personalities that she's absorbed over the years to come out. So one minute she's a Klingon, one minute she's a little girl, one minute she's a Vulcan. Jerry Ryan's a phenomenal actress. And I cannot deny that she added something to the show, but I also cannot deny that, in my opinion, she sucked the air away from everybody else on the show. So to me, I'm mixed on her. I think she's great, but I do think that she took too much. I see your point. But Jennifer Lean, yes, I think she was such a loss that she couldn't stay on the show.
Right. All right. Veronica, your pick for Star Trek Voyager.
Okay. I want to see if anyone, because there's, if you... Watch
I like
that
you set it up.
If you watch my theme, there's really, I think there's only one Voyager episode that I could possibly pick and stay in a theme. So I want to see if anyone other than Chuck, because he already knows it, can guess what my pick is.
Well, there's only one Ferengi episode. Is it that
it
one?
It is.
Oh, no. Ooh,
look at me.
You're kidding. Oh, that's great guess.
False Prophets. Yeah.
False Prophets.
I really, yep. For one, it has the Ferengi, and Ferengi are always hilarious, no matter why they're on there. They're always hilarious. But it ties into what happened to those guys from the TNG episode.
Yeah.
And it brings the TNG back in, because TNG was my Star Trek. I mean, after watching DS9, DS9 is now my Star Trek, but TNG was my first Star Trek. So having that pulled in there. And just the hilariousness of the Fringy. I like the funny episodes. They don't always make sense. They probably don't fit into the timeline very well, but they're always so much fun. So yeah, False Prophets, one single Fringy episode.
To your point about not making sense, I think that's an episode you call a farce, because to your point, I watched that last month, right? And so Chakotay and Tom Paris, they go in there, they see the Fringy, blah, blah, blah. And then they go back to the ship. And they're like, oh, well, how do we get them out of there? And they have this long conversation about, oh, we don't want to violate the Prime Directive. Then you got this, I know it's not a Galaxy-class ship, but then they go, oh, we can't beam them out. They've got a scattering field around the pavilion. I'm thinking, seriously, you're telling me that these Ferengi, whatever they scavenge from one shuttle, are keeping this powerful Starfleet vessel's you know, at the end of the day, there's no way the Fringes should have gotten away with what they got away with. And that, but that actually makes it even funnier. I'm like, man, they're making the entire ship look like clowns. There's no way they shouldn't have got past Janeway and all of them. But it's so silly as it goes through there. It is hilarious.
And I always loved it just from a nerd perspective that you got a sequel to an episode so many years later on a different show. You know, these two Ferengi were dumped off in the Delta Quadrant from the Barzan wormhole and forgotten. And then, sure enough, Voyager comes across them. And it's just like, oh, isn't this the same two guys? Which is, it's just fun.
It is. It's a fun show.
It kind of shows you exactly what would have happened with Quark and family in 1947 had they stayed there.
Right. Good point.
Yeah, except
I didn't even think about that.
Obviously, that general wasn't on this planet because I think humans might have been more devious even than the Ferengi could handle. All right, so that brings us to Star Trek Enterprise, or just Enterprise, depending on what season you're watching. And it's an easy pick for me because Enterprise is not my favorite episode, not my favorite series. I'd say, even including the new shows, Enterprise is my least favorite show of the Star Trek canon. But my favorite episode is Carbon Creek.
Yes.
A group of Vulcans, you know, watching Sputnik and crash landing in 1950s small town America. Watching I Love Lucy, blending in, you get the whole putting the toboggan on his head to cover his ears. It's just, it felt such a throwback to older science fiction that I loved.
That's a good
one. It's a really, really beautiful episode. And it's nice to get a focus on T'Pol and B, some family history for her. And also I love that whole like throwback to you know, Mayberry RFD kind of setting. It's so incongruous with what you expect from a sci-fi show, but it's absolutely lovely and really well done. And I absolutely love the relationship between T'Pol and the captain and Trip. They have such a really wonderful dynamic between the two of them. And I love how she just sort of, you know, is patient and yet impatient with their nonsense. And she's actually my favorite character on the show. So you picked a good one.
And it has nice tie-ins as well with First Contact, with the Vulcans observing the first man-made artificial satellite. And I love the production design of the Vulcan sort of almost kitschy, sort of almost Flash Gordon-y costumes they had on. It's just a little tweak on the regular Vulcan design that gave them that little bit of a spacey look. It's just a fun episode all around.
I always wondered if, since Vulcans can live, depending on the Vulcan, they can live between 200 and 300 years. I think average lifespan is 200. And some like T'Pol, I think T'Pol was 300 when she died. I always wondered if that guy who stayed on Earth could have survived up until the warp time. Could he have been alive when his people came back? It was 110 years later. Depending on his age, he could have still been alive.
Yeah, would have got his ears bobbed.
Yeah.
But and depending on how old he was at the time, he could conceivably have watched the launch of the NX-01. That was 200 years later. And if he was 30, then, you know, he would have been Sarek's age, but could potentially have still been alive and just lived through that entire era of Star Trek history.
And I always wondered, and I think I read in books, because I don't know if they ever said in the series, I always wondered, did he marry and have children? But I think they kind of said in the books that Vulcans and humans, even though they can have children, it's not easy.
Yeah, I think Roddenberry's answer to that back in the day was that they had to have a little bit of help. But,
right,
you know, who knows?
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, good point.
All right, Keith, your pick for Star Trek Enterprise.
Enterprise, I liked it from the start, and I've actually come to like it even more. So I really enjoy Enterprise. Okay. There's so much about the series that I wish they could have done. I know that the creators, Berman and Braga, they wanted the entire first season to take place on Earth. And I know that never would have, you know, that never would have flown. And people criticized them for the Zindi storyline. I didn't like the whole time temporal Cold War thing, but a lot of that stuff people don't realize was pushed by the network. They were pushed to do some of that stuff. So I actually like the show, and I'm a little bit of an outlier in that the season that everybody hails is the best season of Enterprise is season 4.
Right.
It is probably the best produced. It's probably the most fan pleasing. it's not the one I would choose as the best season, because to me there is so much kind of fan service. It hails back to so many other things. Like, it's great seeing In a Mirror Darkly, it's great seeing the Orion Slave Girls, but for me, if you're going to give me a new series, give me new things to look at,
right?
But that, or look at something from a different angle. So that being said, I did actually pick a episode from the fourth season. It's basically the three-part series that culminates in Kishara.
Okay.
And this is the one that basically talks about the fact that there are factions on Vulcan that are starting to resist the ways of logic. There are factions on Vulcans, it turns out, are even embracing perhaps having a relationship with the Romulans, people who don't want humans around them. And it starts with a bombing, Aaron LaForce is killed. It ends up with Archer and T'Pol on Vulcan. And through a whole bunch of things going on, they find the original writings of Sarak, the guy who was responsible for logic on the planet Vulcan, at a time because of all the things going on, the war with the Andorians and being part of Starfleet and this influence behind the scenes of the Romulans, the Vulcan race is at a crossroads where it's possible they may start abandoning logic and maybe even, who knows, pull out of the Federation. And Archer and T'Pol help them find the original writings of Sarak along with T'Pol, a very young T'Pol who's a little bit more of a radical. And they help put Vulcan back on the course again. And they're responsible for a lot of the things that would come to fruition in Kirk's time, such as mind melds being used by some Vulcans. I find it a fascinating show because it shows a different aspect of the Vulcans. One of the things Enterprise cemented that people had debated for so long is they used to say Vulcans can't lie. And we find out that Vulcans absolutely can lie.
Yes.
They just have to have logic behind it. And you see so many things in Enterprise where, like, the Vulcans, they have a listening post inside one of their own places of the dead. Mm. And you realize that the Vulcans are kind of, sort of hypocritical. They're not any better than we are for all that they think they're superior to everybody else. And one of the things I've always thought about Vulcans is interesting. Vulcans put everybody down because they're emotional. But Vulcans, among all the violent races, humans, Andorians, Tellarites, Nausicaans, Klingons, Vulcans are the only race who can't be themselves. Mm. You know, they make fun of everybody, but they can only function by suppressing part of who they are. All the other races, whether you like them or not, Klingons, whatever, they found a way to channel all of their essence. Vulcans literally have to cut off part of who they are to function. And I like this arc of shows because it shows, hey, if they're not careful, they could go back again because they were getting very close. They're murdering people. They're engaging in absolute violence. And because of Archer and T'Pol, they find their path again. It was just a fascinating look at Vulcans as something other than just these purely logical creatures. You get to look a little bit under the hood, as it were, and see what they could be if they're not careful and what they could become again if they're not careful.
Yeah, I enjoyed that entire arc. I thought that very well done. And like you say, a lot of fan service. You get to see a wild sellout and you got T'Pol showing up. But those are some things that, you know, sort of fans had waited for on the show. Now, I like seeing T'Pol. I wish he would have sounded more like Celia Lovsky. You know, just having that character in there is a lot of fun. And I love the oblique references to the people that were fighting on ancient Vulcan, who marched beneath the Raptor's wings, I think is how they phrased it.
Yes.
Where we know who it is, but
right.
Yeah, I thought that was a great myth building episode or series of episodes, really. But I've always enjoyed sort of the Vulcan story.
Right.
You know, the Vulcan mysticism. And I thought they did a great job of finding a guy who looked like an older version of Barry. I forget Barry's last name, who played Surak in The Savage Curtain. It'll come to me. Mm-hmm. Barry something. But they did a great job of just looking at those two actors side by side, and he favors him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Moving on to Alan, your pick for Star Trek Enterprise.
Well, let's see. I think I'm going to go with my second choice again. I'm just a rebel like that. My first pick was the Andorian incident.
That's a good pick.
But since we've all just done, you know, and it introduces the Andorians to the series and it focuses a lot on the Vulcans. Since we just done a Vulcan one, I'm going to shift gears a little bit and I'm going to go with Dear Doctor.
Okay.
which is a great moral dilemma episode. They encounter a race of people that are dying, and they're looking for people to help them solve what they think is an illness that's killing them off. And what it turns out to be is what could be an evolutionary process. There is a second race on their planet that have a genetic marker that would save the dominant race, but the dominant race basically enslaves the secondary race. And it's Dr. Phlox's argument that this is an evolutionary process. The mink, the secondary race, are becoming more prominent, and the dominant race are genetically dying off.
Right.
And it would be wrong to sort of derail what is most likely, and he doesn't know for sure, but it probably is the evolutionary process of this planet, of this society. And it's such a great episode what choice do you make when you only have the amount of evidence that you have in front of you, and you don't know what will happen 1,000 years from now, or, 5,000 years from now, how these two races will develop? What do you do? Do you interfere? Is not helping them interfering, And in addition to that, you also get a couple of other sort of subplots to this. One of them is the introduction of a character called Lieutenant Cutler, who is set up to possibly be a love interest for Phlox. And you find out through this discussion that the Denobulans are a polyamorous people.
Right.
So this is an element that Trek has never dealt with before, and is something that's becoming more, society is becoming more aware of. And Trek sort of puts that in the forefront and makes one of their lead characters from a polyamorous society. And it's not done in a gratuitous way. It's not done in a way that's like, look at us, flaunting this new concept in your face. It's done in a way that makes sense in the storyline.
Right.
You have different Starfleet officers who are basically standing different sides of the debate over what to do with this new society that's dying off. And some of them see the mink as being enslaved, and they rush to their defense, even though the mink have never asked to be helped. They haven't asked to be set free from what the Starfleet characters see as their oppressors. And it's just a really interesting, what would in a later series be a Prime Directive episode, but the Prime Directive doesn't exist yet. And it's from this episode that the concept is first introduced. In the original script, it was going to have a different ending. Phlox and Archer were going to end on a disagreement about what to do with these things. And in the episode as it aired, in sort of the final scene, Archer comes around and comes to Phlox's understanding a little too quickly.
Yeah.
But he says, until there is, sort of a primary guide that we should follow, I have to remember that I'm not out here to play God.
Right.
So it's sort of like this shoehorned point at the very last scene, which you could tell was hastily rewritten to fit the way that the studio wanted it to go. But it makes sense in the way that Starfleet has developed, and the way that Enterprise is telling that story of Starfleet's development.
Right.
So it's a fascinating episode. I absolutely love it.
Yeah. And I think the line was, until someone drafts that directive. We got it. Guys.
Exactly. I know.
That was the only thing that makes you groan when they actually did that. I hate it when they do something like that. That's the only thing, you're right. That made me groan when they actually put the term in there. Like, you don't need to, you don't need to say that.
That's almost Mr. Solo,
level.
But like Alan was saying though, it's a very interesting pre-Prime Directive episode of where these rules aren't set up. Yeah. It's really just up to him to figure it out. And that's the sort of thing that I liked. And I thought was one of the things they could have done more of in that era was, we don't have this directive yet? What do we do? You know, and it's really, it's down to us to figure it out. And that's one of those episodes too, that I think still resonates. I saw a headline just in the last week or two of, you know, just something going around on Facebook. Did Archer commit genocide? You know, with a picture of him and Phlox from this episode. It's one of those similar to Tuvix's, right, where people will still talk about it.
Exactly.
Yeah. To your point, and that's one of the reasons I actually really, really like the series Enterprise, is because when they got it right, it was all about humanity needing to mature, because T'Pol and Phlox, having come from much more mature spacefaring races, their attitude is, it's not your business, and you can interfere with the natural order. But Archer, being from a society that's relatively immature in these matters out in space, he's struggling with it. And as you said, your first thought is, well, I want to help these people. But if he helped the dominant species and also the Mink were in servitude, there's just no other way to say it. Mm. You know, they were like indentured servants. So if you save the dominant species, you were going to condemn the Mink to generations of servitude. And if you save the Mink, well, maybe the dominant species would die out. But again, it's not your call.
Right.
And so I thought it was a great moral dilemma there.
Yeah.
I agree with that, that it was a fascinating study of what do you do?
One of the things that I feel that Enterprise really got right, and it's been said a couple of times, is that whole feeling of stepping out into the unknown for the first time. They're the first Earth-based ship that is heading out into the great unknown, basically. And having to figure out how to do it, how to have first contact with an alien species, how to rein yourself in, how to conduct yourself in a galactic neighborhood, basically. And I think that that's one of the joys of watching it, is that everything that you see on the show, these characters are experiencing on behalf of the human race for the very first time. And I think that they did a magnificent job of showing those first footsteps out into a larger world, a world that we have sort of known about. We've known that it's there, but have had no experience in. And I think it's, I just love it. That's one of the things that I love about the show the most.
And one of the things I like about that episode too, is that it kind of, given the time and the technology, it brought back one of Roddenberry's themes from the original series, which was the whole, so many times where the point was Kirk was out there by himself. And even if he wanted to get orders from Starfleet, it would be days or weeks before a subspace signal would get to Starfleet and back. So many times Kirk had to make a decision on his own because he couldn't get a decision from headquarters in a timely fashion. And to your point, in this case, Archer was way out there and he didn't have time to wait for a signal to get all the way to Admiral Forrest and back. And so it's that thing where he's like a lone pioneer out there having to make these decisions on the fly because there's no one else.
And I love that. The sort of the atmosphere too of, you know, they'll say we're from Earth. What's that? You know, you don't have the power of the Earth or Federation reputation backing you. Earth is just one of the planets out there, you know, that no one's ever heard of. All right, Veronica, your choice for Star Trek Enterprise.
So, the bulk of my Star Trek introduction, with the exception of TNG, because that's what was on when I was kid, teenager, was introduced to me through Charles. So
you've probably seen three Enterprise episodes, is what you're saying.
So the one I remember, of course, is Carbon Creek, which is what we talked about at first.
What you're saying is that you've not seen Acquisition.
Is there a Ferengi one?
There's a Ferengi one. and it has Jeffrey Combs in it.
And okay, because that was
that's where I was
gonna go next. Like, this was the one I liked, but really anything with Jeffrey Combs. Yeah.
So
fantastic.
Veronica's homework will be watching Acquisition.
Awesome.
And also the one with the dinosaurs, because I never saw that one either.
Okay.
Voyager.
So yeah, so as Veronica's flashing backwards through her life, she'll say on this podcast that she loved Acquisition.
That's great.
And so I made a mistake, which I'm embarrassed about. I skipped an entire Star Trek.
Yes, you did. And I was wondering if that was on purpose or not.
No, I was about two sentences into talking about yesterday's Enterprise. And I thought, shame on me,
right?
Because I'm a person who I for 12 years was the writer of a webcomic based on Star Trek the Animated Series. I've been championing that show for a long time. Wow. And so we'll say it was on purpose, and I'm circling around now to the animated show.
That's cool.
And now my pick, which is not going to be a table turner here. You know, it's not going to be anything revolutionary, but I'm going to go with the obvious choice and say Yesteryear.
Yeah.
Known on Viewmaster as Mr. Spock's Time Trek, where Spock goes back in time through the Guardian of Forever, right. And it's simultaneously a sequel to City on the Edge of Forever and Journey to Babel, as Spock goes back in time, visiting his childhood home, posing as his own uncle. We get to meet Ichaya, his pet Sellet. You get a nice little sort of Saturday morning morality play going on as young Spock gets to choose whether Ichaya lives or whether Ichaya dies. It's a fun episode, but also it's probably the episode of the animated series that added more to the lore of Star Trek, mm-hmm. and has been referenced so many times.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And it shows you so much about the Vulcans. The Vulcans are an incredible race because this kid was 7 years old. And they were going to send him out in the forge. That's the rite of passage. You got to go out into the forge. On Earth, it'd be like taking a seven-year-old child and dumping him in Death Valley or the Sahara Desert.
Right.
And he was going to have to survive. That's Vulcans are just no joke. I mean, you know, that's just amazing. They're like Shaolin monks, and, you know, for something like that. Because and the whole thing is he died because he went early. But I always wondered, would he have died anyway? You know, because Spock saved him. It's old Spock save young Spock, but I wonder how many Vulcan children die in the test of the Forge, to be honest. Oh,
plenty, yeah. I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's dragons and things out there.
You know, it's, yeah.
That's why I'd say it's worse than Death Valley. There's, yeah. You know, there's dinosaur creatures out there.
Yeah, that's a great show.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, even up to Star Trek 2009, they're delivering almost exact quotes from Yesteryear in that movie. It's just the staying power of that episode. That's the staying power of that episode is impressive to me.
I like the when Ichaya gets poisoned by the creature that sounds just like Godzilla, because you know,
yes. Apparently
had somebody found him.
I love that.
This is great. I laugh every time, but I like when he goes to the healer. And the healer basically says, oh, I don't know if I can trust you. And I'm sure it's because you're half human and you're known to play jokes. And he goes, have you ever heard that the son of Sarek is a liar? No, that I have not heard. And I thought it was wild when he crossed over into becoming, well, not even, you know, you don't even have to become logical, because there's so many books like this, like where the Red Fern Girls and stuff, where children have to deal with life.
Right.
Old Yeller and stuff like that. But in his case, it pushed into logic, which was, do you want your pet to linger on or do you want to give him a death? And given that this was kind of thought to be a Saturday morning cartoon for kids,
yeah,
you know, I don't know honestly if it was, you know, Disney back in the day was way more mature than Disney is now for kids. I don't know if that cartoon aimed at kids gets made like that today, where he basically says, let him die, and let him die peacefully, and yeah, let him go in honor. That's a really powerful scene. And how cool was it back then to have an Andorian first officer?
Right. Yeah.
Even if he was the wrong color.
Yes.
My headcanon is that he was half Andorian, like Spock was half.
I mean, that makes perfect sense to me. I'm fine with that.
That's a good one.
I'm going to guess that something like Gilligan's Planet didn't have a heavy morality episode ending like this episode had.
Right.
All right, Keith, your pick for Star Trek, the animated series.
This is the time where I go to, Yesteryear is a great show. There's a lot of other ones, but this is time where I go to something that I can just watch over and over and over again. And I think because of the science fiction aspect, and that's the one called The Slaver Weapon.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's a great, The Slaver Weapon basically deals with this, an ancient empire of beings called the slavers because they ruled most of the galaxy a billion years in the past. And they had these things called stasis boxes, slaver boxes. Basically, they put something inside a box and it has a stasis field inside of it, and it literally doesn't age. And Spock, Uhura, and Sulu are lured to a trap by this race of beings created by a famous science fiction writer, Larry Niven, called the Zenti, these giant cat-like aliens. And they discover a slaver weapon, which is, has incredible power. It can morph into any instrument. You hold it and push a button, it's a telescope. You hold it, push a button, it's a little rocket thing. You hold it and push a button. And they found the ultimate setting, it was a literally beam of matter to energy conversion. And I just love the show because of the science fiction, the whole concept of the slavers. I love things like the old ones and what a little girl's made of. And all these, right. I love references to ancient races that ruled the galaxy or died off. I love the concept of the Kzinti, a true feline race of incredibly fierce beings. And one guy kept talking about, you keep messing with, we're going to eat you, because he says, none of my men have tasted human flesh as my ancestors did. I would welcome the opportunity. It's just a great science fiction show. I just love everything about that. So every time I watch it, I just get thrilled. Every time they fire that matter to energy conversion beam and it blows up, I just love it. It's just a fun, scientifically entertaining episode.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think a lot of that comes from it being originally a short story by Larry Niven that he adapted to Star Trek. But right. I think as a result of that, you get that interesting dynamic where it's basically what Spock, Sulu, and Uhura.
Yes.
And there's no Enterprise. Mm-hmm. They're just out there on their own.
There's no Enterprise, but there's right. also no Kirk. It's the right. only episode yeah. that yes. Shatner was not in.
Right.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah. I wouldn't mind seeing, not that I don't like Shatner, well, but I like the unusual dynamic of it where you're mm-hmm. sort of, you know, outside of the general framework of the show.
One of the things that I love about the animated series is that it gave some of the, what you would think of as secondary characters, a lot more to do. And particularly Uhura.
Right.
She had a number of episodes where her character was much stronger than she ever would have been in the original series. This is one of those. Mm. And exactly. and certainly the Lorelei yes. signal where
right.
she takes command of the ship never yep. would have happened in the original series. And so the animated series was very good to Sulu and Uhura, but particularly Uhura.
Absolutely.
But no Chekhov, sadly.
Yeah, but he did get to write an episode. So.
All right, Alan, your pick for Star Trek, the animated series.
All right. I am going to the very beginning, the first episode, Beyond the Farthest Star. I don't think
love
that
it.
You would
love
think
it.
Of it necessarily as the best episode, because there are episodes that are better than it. But the thing that I absolutely love about it is that everything that happens in that episode is telling you we are the same show as the original series, but at the same time, right. we are completely different. It tackles things that you could never have done in the original series. They come across this, I think it's like a 300 million year old pod ship. So it's basically sort of like this organic plant kind of ship. And the thing that I love about it is the design. This thing is so incredibly, I mean, this is like artistic. It's so well done. Right. It's so well thought out. The way that the paintings are done is just incredible. And so this episode is telling you, yeah, we are Star Trek, but we are going to do Star Trek the way you have never, ever seen it before and would never have been able to see it before.
Yeah.
And it is just a true visual feast. I absolutely love
it. Oh, yeah. And it has the glimpses of the alien species that piloted that ship, that they're not humanoid.
Exactly.
You
That's
know,
true.
It's and like you say, I love that as the first episode of the animated
series.
Yeah,
it comes out strong. Like it like, rockets out of the gate. Yeah.
Now we're getting weird.
I love it. And you're right, because they said that Spock mentioned that the shape of the doors reminded him of bees.
Yeah.
And when they looked at the superstructure of the ship, Scotty says, look at this material. It looks like it was spun or mm-hmm. woven. Not like, you know, not rolled like metal. And yeah, they were incredibly, incredibly artistic and creative. And you're right, they could not have done that in the original series. Also, that thing was so many times bigger than
Oh, yeah, it was enormous.
Yeah.
So it may not have been the best episode, but it was definitely one of the boldest episodes. And it was a really bold way to launch a new series.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like the way they played with some stuff. They didn't have the science now. Like, they kept talking about the Dark Star, which could have been, I guess it could have been a neutron star, because it couldn't have been a black hole. But, you know, they were playing around with some of the science. And to your point, they also introduced a couple of things that made sense, like the security device
right,
on the bridge.
Right. It was kind of cool.
You got a laser beam.
Absolutely. You never saw it again, but it was a neat concept.
Yeah, that's actually my second choice, my second favorite episode. Every time I go to animated series, I keep watching The Slaver Weapon and that episode over and over and over.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great episode.
Yeah, it's a great one. And I love the force field belts. I think that's a very clever way around having to draw spacesuits.
Yes.
But also, it's just a cool future technology. Why not?
Absolutely.
And it's the sort of storytelling on that episode that I wish they would do more of on Star Trek now that they have the budget and the technology to do these big, weird sci-fi things. Because that's a mind blower. That episode, it's especially if it's 12. All right, Veronica, your choice for Star Trek the Animated Series.
Okay, so despite being married to this guy, I've probably only actually seen 3 episodes, and the only one I remember was yesteryear.
So you haven't seen the Ferengi episode of Animated Series.
there he's joking with you. Just keep watching the animated series until you find the Ferengi episode. I reminded her today that she's also seen More Tribbles, More Troubles, and she's also seen The Magics of Meg-Ess 2.
Those are good.
But you must have fallen asleep during those. So.
And it's only 22 minutes. Wait, so come on.
We watch a lot of Deep Space Nine in this house.
Choice. So
she has some catching gaps up to do.
I do really like the Glommers, though. So...
Yep.
I'll go with Tribble too. And we have a pink Tribble here and we have a Glommer. So there we go.
Beautiful.
We go
yeah, More Tribbles, More Troubles, I thought was a surprisingly, for an animated series, an animated spinoff of a TV show that had come out in the previous decades, the Star Trek cartoon could have been terrible. Mm-hmm. It could have been, two kids and a dog on the Enterprise. Instead, they've got David Gerald back, they've got Stanley Adams back, Kor was back, although it was one of James Doohan's 4 cartoon voices. But it's a surprisingly, true episode to its predecessor, The Trouble with Tribbles, which, I don't think anyone would argue that it's as good, but it's fun.
It is fun.
It's very fun. It's very fun. I think that defines, it's funny. I know I'm older than everybody else. I talk to and see so many people on Facebook who haven't even seen the original series, and let alone the animated series. And I've had a lot of conversations on other matters with people who I know who are, say, younger than me. I know people in their 30s and 40s who have never seen a movie made before like 1970. They will not watch black and white movies. I keep a catalog of 12 silent movies in my list all the time. I watch silent movies all the time. And the reason I'm saying all this is, to your point, the animated series is written incredibly well. Mm-hmm. It has some of the worst production value you will ever see in a cartoon. But I think we can look past that. And since I grew up watching Lost in Space and stuff, I can absolutely look past. Like, I can watch the original series and I can see the paper mache rocks. I don't care. There's great science fiction taking place. Like on The Slaver Weapon, the freaking Kzinti cats have pink uniforms because the main guy in charge of production was colorblind. And that's why so many of the colors in the anime series are off. The guy couldn't see. And, as everybody knows, they use the same music over and over and over. I'm watching the episode that you talked about, Alan, with Beyond the Farthest Star. And when the Bing, either when they transport down or back, Mr. Kyle has a mustache. and he shouldn't have a mustache. And then he doesn't have a mustache.
He realized he shouldn't have one, and he got rid of it.
Yes. And in The Slaver Weapon, Sulu is talking, and you look at it, it's Kirk. Somehow they had Kirk on the screen. But it's a really, really well-written series. And I hate not that I have a problem with them, but I feel for people who say, I can't watch it because it looks so bad. It's really a good
series. The bad thing about it is, it was produced by the Filmation Company, and they did most of the Saturday morning cartoons. So it looked like everything else that was being shown at the time. If it wasn't Hanna-Barbera, it was Filmation. And so it's absolutely of its time. And I think that things like Beyond the Farthest Star shows how much, character-wise, it may look a little rudimentary, and it may look like what was happening at the time. But when you're talking about the overall design of the, the narrative landscape, I think that they really stepped outside of what they normally would have done, and really turned out some beautiful work.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And bringing characters like Maress in, which
right, and Eryx back then. Oh yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yep.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, and if you compare it to something like Avatar The Last Airbender or something like that, it will suffer by comparison. But comparing it to the shows of the day, I mean, like I had mentioned Gilligan's Planet earlier, or the Lost in Space cartoon that no one remembers, you know. But I think that Star Trek, it was head and shoulders above the other shows of its type, you know. I know there was an I Dream of Jeannie one that Mark Hamill was involved with when he was young, but there were a lot at that time, a lot of really crappy cartoon versions of 60s TV shows. And that Star Trek has the original cast. You've got writers like David Gerrold, Dorothy Fontana, Larry Niven. You're just top tier sci-fi writers writing for the show. I think it's comparing it to what it was around at the time, I think it's head and shoulders above them. And I think it holds up with that in mind really well. And it's funny that people criticize it now when shows like Archer are aping that style.
That's a good point. I hadn't even thought about that. Very good point. Yeah, you're right. Because Filmation produced a show that I despise. It was the series that unfortunately won the copyright to the name Ghostbusters, but it wasn't the Ghostbusters based on. It was the one where the gorilla was driving the jalopy. That show was so horrible. That was Filmation. And they even did a series that I saw as a kid that was horrible. I only watched it because it was the last thing that they'd show like on Saturday morning cartoon blocks. It was U.S. of Archie. And it was Archie doing all these kind of history lessons and stuff like that. It wasn't very good. But yeah, Filmation was not a good animation studio, but it was a great show.
No, but Filmation, they had to cut corners, but they kept a lot of artists working in America when a lot of companies were going overseas to save money.
So absolutely. Plus the output. And if you enjoyed it, was staggering for its time. Yeah. So.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. And then when they got into live action stuff, if you enjoy the music of Star Trek, the animated series, watch Jason of Star Command or Space Academy, and you'll hear those same musical.
And I haven't thought about those shows in a long time.
That's
on YouTube.
And I know we're running long, but I really don't mean to kill Filmation, because they also did some fantastic shows that I watch and love, like Brave Star and Flash Gordon cartoon. And one of the Batman cartoons. So they did a lot of good stuff.
Oh yeah, I grew up on Super Friends and Flash Gordon and He-Man.
They did the Tarzan cartoon at the same time as the Batman cartoon, as the same time Brave Star. As a matter of fact, the same actor voiced all those guys.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of the legacy Star Trek series, sort of getting to know one another and getting to know what our favorites are, sort of the age, sex, location of Star Trek fans is what's your favorite episode. So this has been a lot of fun, guys.
Absolutely. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Absolutely. Loved it. Could have gone on for a couple more hours.
That's right.
Well, because now we have to do round two of our second picks for each series.
Right. All right. It's going to be a long podcast. Thank you for listening to Earth Station Trek. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. Give us a positive rating. You can also send us feedback at earthstationtrek@gmail.com. You can join in the fun on our Facebook group or follow us on Twitter. You can also visit us online at earthstationtrek.podbean.com. We'll see you next time. Live long and prosper.